Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Well, hello there and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, music from Palestrina to Taverna for Our Lady's Assumption into Heaven. And time to remember as the Church celebrates the feast of Saint Maximilian Kolbe. Well, thanks so much for joining me. I'd like to begin today on a musical note by bringing you a comment on the fourth glorious mystery of the Rosary, which focuses on Our Lady's Assumption into Heaven. As I mentioned a moment ago, Palestrina and Taverna are on the agenda. All that with music historian Monsignor Philip Whitmore.
Assumpta est Maria in cielo.
Assumpta est Maria. Mary has been assumed into heaven. The angels rejoice. They sing for joy and praise the Lord. This is what we celebrate in the fourth glorious mystery of the Rosary. Christian art loves to depict the scene with Mary borne aloft by angels, while the disciples gasp with astonishment from earth below. And any text about rising to heaven is a gift for a composer. Listen to the joyful, surging scales in Giovanni Pierluigi da Palestrina's motet Assumpta est Maria. Palestrina's music has always been held up as a model of the most perfect form of Renaissance polyphony. He became something of a legendary figure in the 19th century among those who wanted to revive the sacred choral style of the 16th century. It's easy to see why. The classical purity of this intricate interweaving of voices seems to evoke the perfection of a bygone age. And at the same time, the glory of the world to come. For those of us living in Rome, the name Palestrina has a local ring because it's the name of a small town a short distance away, a good place to go for a day out of the city. Pope Julius III had been the Bishop of Palestrina before he was elected to the papacy, and when he moved to Rome, he brought with him his former cathedral organist, Giovanni Pierluigi. Unlike many Roman composers of the time, Palestrina was not a cleric. He was married with a family. In fact, an exception was made for him to sing in the Cappella Sistina, normally open only to celibates. He did consider entering the priesthood after his first wife died, but it was not to be, and in due course he married for a second time. The doctrine of Our Lady's Assumption has a long history, even though it was only in 1950 that it was solemnly defined as a dogma of faith by Pope Pius XII. It has a particularly venerable tradition in the Eastern churches. St. John Damascene, for example, wrote beautifully about the mystery. In the East, it's normally referred to as the Dormition of Our Lady. Let's listen now to a musical meditation on this theme for the unusual combination of string quartet and handbells, written by the living English composer John Taverner, himself a member of the Orthodox Church. It's called The Last Sleep of the Virgin.
Thank you.
that air of mysticism evoked through the simplest of means is characteristic of John Taverner. His music is deeply religious, and it often achieves its effect through constant repetition, almost like a musical mantra. That makes it seem particularly appropriate for a meditation on the Rosary. I'd like to finish with one of Taverner's most important works to date. The Protecting Veil, written in 1988, is a piece for solo cello and string orchestra based on a vision of Our Lady sheltering the beleaguered Christians beneath her all-encompassing veil. In the composer's own words, the Mother of God is represented by the cello and never stops singing throughout. The accompanying string music is a gigantic extension of her unending song. We've been listening to a passage from the sixth movement, entitled The Dormition of the Mother of God. And let's allow ourselves, as we listen, to be transported into contemplation of that great and glorious mystery.
Heartfelt thanks there, as always, to Monsignor Philip Whitmore, a music historian currently working as an official at the Vatican's Secretariat of State. Meanwhile, time to mark a special feast day which falls on the 14th of August, the day the Church remembers Saint Maximilian Kolbe, who was born in Poland in 1894 and who died in the Auschwitz concentration camp in 1941. A man who was among those Pope Benedict XVI paid tribute to when he visited this concentration camp. Stay tuned as I tell that story, which begins with the Jewish prayer of mourning we heard on that occasion. Haunting music we heard there in what was just one of the many concentration camps in Poland, Auschwitz. There were many, many more, as Pope Benedict stressed himself when he visited there. By the way, the exact date was May the 28th, 2006. Geographically right at the heart of Europe, it once housed interns from up to 29 nations. They came from the four corners of this continent. Just to mention a few, Marie Kafka from Prague, Sarah Komkoan from Amsterdam, Petr Eisler from Germany. Names that struck me when I visited to report prior to Pope Benedict's visit. I picked out their names written in white paint on suitcases, a jumble of them piled high behind a glass case of the museum, located within the concentration camp. Petrus had his birth date on it. He was a year old when he reached there. He lived less than a week. These suitcases, I thought, are all that's left to identify the interns there. On second thoughts, that's not really true. It's not all that's left. The SS kept everything, wasted nothing. From the interns' hair, they made textiles. From the ashes that emerged from the crematorium, fertilizer. The list could go on and on and on. Even young, healthy children were not wasted. They were taught a skill so they would eventually serve the Third Reich. But as I discovered, most never even passed that selection, were never even afforded the privilege of working in a labour camp. They were never allowed to have a purplish number branded on their arms. Only ordered to undress, remember the number of the coat hanger they would never again set eyes on. and taken straight to the four huge gas chambers complete with crematoria that could handle 200,000 bodies at a time. Valley of death, an abyss of terror. Two expressions among many used by Pope Benedict to describe this sobering place as he entered the camp on foot under overcast skies. Under the minimalist-looking wrought-iron gate, which reads in German, Arbeit macht frei, meaning work makes you free. A cynical slogan indeed, when you realise it was through this gate that thousands of prisoners filed daily, heading out of the camp to work as slave labourers for Poland's Nazi German occupiers during World War II. No doubt, it must have been a tough task for a German Pope as he walked past the double row of barbed wire fences, interspersed with ominous watchtowers, down the tree-lined cobble paths flanking the red brick barracks, which today house the museum I was talking about earlier, heading to the infamous block number 11, called by the prison interns the Block of Death, where SS held tribunals, and where still today, for record's sake, a photograph of Hitler is nailed to the wall. And when Pope Benedict reached the smallish yard attached to it, he went to the very place where prisoners were once executed, namely the execution wall. And 30 or so survivors of these former prisons were there to greet him, 61 years after they walked to freedom. People still branded with a number and certainly haunted by that horrific memory. But you know, there's one person who wasn't there. He died 50 or so years after he'd been first condemned. A family man who St. Maximilian Kolbe offered his life for all those years ago. And it was to Kolbe's cell, number 18, that Pope Benedict went, down the dank stairs to the cells. A row of them still stand in memory of the thousands who starved to death here, or, like this saint, died from an injection of carbolic acid. In Latin, Pope Benedict whispered, "Maximilian Kolbe and the holy martyrs, pray for us." But when he went by car a little later to the Birkenau part of the Auschwitz complex, where most of the 1.5 million people died simply because most people who came to this extermination camp were the ones who were considered useless to society, it rained, and all the while he prayed there, walking silently alongside the tablets which bear inscriptions in memory of those who died. Inscriptions which speak of human grief, he was later to say, giving us a glimpse of the cynicism of that regime which treated men and women as material objects and failed to see them as persons embodying the image of God. Some inscriptions are pointed reminders. There's one in Hebrew which reads, "The rulers of the Third Reich wanted to crush the entire Jewish people, to cancel it from the register of the peoples of the earth." And when the German Pope spoke, the rain ceased.
Davanti alla innumerevole schiera di coloro che qui hanno sofferto e sono stati messi a morte.
To speak in this place of horror, he said in Italian, this place where unprecedented mass crimes were committed against God and man is almost impossible. And it is particularly difficult and troubling for a Christian, for a Pope from Germany. In a place like this, words fail. In the end, there can only be dread silence, a silence which is itself a heartfelt cry to God. Why, Lord, did you remain silent? How could you tolerate all this? In silence, then, we bow our heads before the endless line of those who suffered and were put to death here. Yet our silence becomes in turn a plea for forgiveness and reconciliation, a plea to the living God never to let this happen again. remembering should lead to prayers for the grace of reconciliation, the Pope went on to say. First of all, from God, who alone can open and purify our hearts from the men and women who suffered here. And finally, the grace of reconciliation for all those who at this hour of our history are suffering in new ways from the power of hatred and the violence which hatred spawns. And when Pope Benedict XVI finished speaking, it was no longer raining. A rainbow stood out against the skyline, against the barbed wire of this place of memory. Now we've glanced back at Pope Benedict's visit to Auschwitz, I'd like you to join my colleague, Jill Bevilacqua, as she imagines for us Maximilian Kolbe's plight. Watch the change of tone for this dramatisation.
The place is Auschwitz. The date, 1941. It's a hot July evening. 600 men in the striped uniform of the concentration camp are returning to base after an exhausting day's work in the cornfields. The corn is high, and the call to freedom is strong. A prisoner escapes. His absence is noticed at roll call that evening, and the camp commander, Colonel Fritsch, tells the men of Block 14 that if their companion is not found within 24 hours, 10 of them will die.
All next day, while the other prisoners are on different work assignments, the men of Block 14 stand to attention in the parade ground. If a prisoner faints, he is kicked and beaten till he gets up again. Those who are unable to rise are left in a heap. Later, they will be thrown onto a coal truck. Destination, the gas ovens.
The fugitive has not been caught. Colonel Fritsch announces that he will now choose 10 victims. They'll be taken to Block 13, the underground bunker, and left to starve to death.
One man after another is chosen and dragged from his place in the ranks. Then comes the turn of Francis Gajovnicek, and he cries out in anguish for his wife and children.
Just at that moment, a man steps out of line and begins to walk slowly towards the group of doomed men. The guards raise their rifles, but the man takes no notice and continues walking. He is soon face to face with the camp commander.
What do you think you're doing?
If it please the Lager Führer, I want to take the place of prisoner Gajovnicek.
Are you crazy?
No, but I am alone in the world. His family needs him. Please.
Who are you, anyway? What's your job?
I am a Catholic priest. Maximilian Kolbe.
All right. Take your boots off. Dead men don't need boots.
One of the stranger aspects of martyrdom is that a number of those who have suffered it knew their destiny long beforehand and accepted it.
Raymond, later Maximilian Kolbe, belongs to this category of martyrs. That he knew his destiny was revealed by his mother in a letter she wrote after hearing of his manner of death. The episode she recounts took place when Kolbe was about 10 years old.
He was a lively child, very bright and just a bit mischievous. I remember one night he got home very late. He was dirty all over and his jacket was torn and his father was furious with him. Next day, while I was mending his jacket, I said to him, "Whatever will become of you, child?" And he burst into tears and ran from the room. Later, I asked him what was the matter, and he told me he had gone to ask Our Lady what would become of him. He said she had opened her arms and shown him two garlands of flowers, one white and one red, and asked him which one he preferred. The white flowers were for purity, the red for martyrdom. Raymond said he would take them both.
At the age of 17, Raymond Colby became Friar Maximilian Mary and was sent to Rome to study for the priesthood. He was ordained on April 28, 1918. But even before ordination, he'd founded an organization for the conversion of sinners, the Militia of Mary Immaculate. On October 16, 1917, seven Franciscan friars, like the knights of old, went down on bended knee and swore fealty to Mary. Soon, the monthly magazine, Knight of the Immaculate, had reached a circulation of 60,000. In 1927, Father Colby found a piece of marshy land about 25 miles from Warsaw, and there he founded what was to become the world's largest monastery, known as the City of the Immaculate. By 1939, it had more than 750 friars and was turning out a million copies a month of The Knight.
But other forces, the forces of evil, were at work, and Poland was soon overrun by the Nazis. Even before Warsaw fell, Father Colby had been arrested. He was released shortly after, but he knew it was not for long. He sent all but 50 of his friars away, to their families, to the north, to safety. He set up a haven for refugees and published a last issue of his magazine. "No one in the world can alter truth," he wrote. "All we can do is seek it and live it."
The Gestapo came for him on February 17th, 1941. 20 of his friars offered to take his place in prison, but in vain. Father Colby spent 2 months in a Warsaw prison, and then, with 320 others, he was bundled into a cattle truck, and after 4 days' journey, reached his final destination, the labor camp at Auschwitz. Over the door was a great sign: "Work makes you free." That day, May 28th, 1941, Father Maximilian Colby became number 16,670. There was no mistaking. It was branded forever on his left arm.
Colby was assigned to Block 17, reserved for priests, whom the camp commander defined useless beings and parasites of society. Tied to a cart with other Polish priests, Colby pulled heavy loads of gravel, cut down trees, dragged logs and branches along rough paths. One day he fell under a heavier load than usual. The guard was merciless. He laid Colby on the trunk and beat him 50 times with his stick. When Christ was scourged, the lashes were 49, the number prescribed by Roman law.
Colby was left for dead, and his fellow priests covered him with green branches as they passed. But when night fell, Colby managed to drag himself to the cell block. Next day, he was transferred to the infection center. He was covered with bruises and had a high fever. But he survived, and although weighing less than 100 pounds, he refused to sleep on a proper bed, insisting on a wooden bunk with a straw mattress. Dr. Rudolf Diem, the Polish doctor who cared for him, later recalled that he wanted to leave the bed to someone whose lot was worse than his. He was unable to work, and so received only half the ration of food. But he still gave some of it away to other patients. "You are young," he would say. "You must survive."
"For myself, I pray only to be reduced to dust in the service of the Immaculate, and to have my ashes blown to the four winds."
Colby's prayer was answered. As soon as he felt better, he was moved to Block 14, the farm workers' block. It was the 20th of July. Just a few days later, a man made a historic dash for freedom.
Ten men lay naked on the cement floor of the dank underground cell of Block 13. Sometimes they moaned or cried aloud in delirium. Sometimes, thankfully, they lost consciousness. But there was a difference between this group of prisoners and the hundreds who had gone to their deaths before them. Every so often, they were heard praying and even singing, so loudly that prisoners from the cells nearby joined in, and the guards had to order them to be silent.
As long as they had strength, Colby and his men prayed and sang. The guards, unnerved by their calm in the face of death, eventually refused to go near the death cell. A Polish orderly had to remove the bodies of those who had died.
By the end of a fortnight, there were only four men alive in Block 13. But the cell was needed for other victims. Colonel Fritsch gave orders to finish off the survivors. And at noon, on August 14th, vigil of the Assumption, a male nurse entered the death cell and injected carbolic acid into the arm of each man. Father Kolbe, who was kneeling by the wall in prayer, comforted his companions in their last moments, as he had comforted so many others throughout his imprisonment. Smiling, he held out his arm for the needle.
Maximilian Kolbe was beatified by Pope Paul VI on October the 17th, 1971. And among the 8,000 pilgrims who came from Poland was 70-year-old Francis Gajowniczek, the man for whom he had offered his life. When the offertory gifts were brought to the Pope, Francis led the procession. Kolbe was beatified not as a martyr, but as a confessor, although Paul VI in fact described him as a martyr of love. But whenever the name of Kolbe was mentioned, in newspapers, in sermons, in monographic studies, it was always as a martyr.
And so, on October 10th, 1982, the Polish Pope, John Paul II, declared Kolbe a saint and a martyr.
In questa morte, terribile dal punto di vista umano, tutta la definitiva grandezza dell'atto umano e della scelta umana.
In his homily, Pope John Paul II said, "In the death of Maximilian Kolbe was the whole definitive greatness of the human act and of the human choice."
La morte di Massimiliano Kolbe divenne un segno di vittoria.
His death was a sign of victory. Victory won over all the system of contempt and hate for man and for what is divine in man. A victory like that won by our Lord Jesus Christ on Calvary.
La morte subita per amore al posto del fratello è un atto eroico dell'uomo.
Death undergone out of love in the place of one's brother is a heroic act of man through which we glorify God. For from God comes the grace of such heroism, of this martyrdom.
Di tale eroismo, di questo martirio.
Every year, scattered over the fields of Auschwitz, are hundreds and hundreds of red and white flowers.
Warm thanks there to Gilbert Vilacqua for this moving programme, part of a series by the title of Witness, in which she attempts to discover what it is that makes a martyr, a series produced by Sean Patrick Lovett. And that brings us up to time. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast.
You've been listening to the English programme of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.